Welcome to this One Just World Forum at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. My name's Peter Mayers. I present The National Interest, a weekly public policy discussion program on ABC Radio National. One Just World is a national partnership between the Australian Government's International Development Agency, AusAid, the International Women's Development Agency, World Vision Australia, and a university in each state. And in this case, we're joined by Melbourne University, as well as the Melbourne Writers' Festival, of course. One Just World aims to advance development and human rights through public engagement, enabling audiences to talk with people directly involved in these issues, make suggestions, contribute ideas, get involved. Respecting the rights and contributions of Indigenous peoples must be integral to just development, and in that spirit, I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Our topic this evening is, does charity begin at home? And we have three fantastic speakers, Sharon Bagwan-Rolls, Gareth Evans and Joe Chandler, and I'll introduce them to you in a moment as they share their insights and experience with you. I'm going to throw questions at them for about half an hour or so, and then I'm going to invite further questions from you in the audience. Before I introduce our speakers and get us underway, a bit of housekeeping. We are recording tonight's forum for The National Interest on ABC Radio National and for Big Ideas on ABC TV. Big Ideas, of course, on Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and on Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. on ABC News 24. And so you'll be able to catch this session as well, also on the Melbourne Writers' Festival website, I think. So you've been asked to turn off your mobile phones. As long as you turn the ringer off, that's right. If you really feel the need to tweet, you can do that. There's even a hashtag for this forum, and that's one, as in the numeral one, JW, Just World. So to introduce our guests more fully, immediately on my right, Sharon Bagwan-Rolls is the coordinator and founder of FemLink Pacific Community Media Initiatives for Women, a Fijian non-government organisation focusing on women's human rights issues. She's also known as the suitcase radio woman, having enabled women's voices and perspectives to be heard by political leaders using simple mobile radio kit. Sharon has an acute interest in media, obviously, as well as policy towards women, peace and security. She's a former vice president of the National Council of Women in Fiji. She's the current co-chair of the Pacific Working Group for a Regional Action Plan on Women, Peace and Security. And she's been very involved with the UN Security Council and its resolution on women and security. Gareth Evans in the middle, nearly forgot him. Gareth Evans is a professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne. He's the Chancellor of the Australian National University. He's President Emeritus of the International Crisis Group, and that's a remarkable organisation that he led for most of the first decade of the 21st century. An organisation with a mission of researching, preventing and resolving deadly conflict. Gareth Evans co-chaired the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, and he put forward a realistic agenda in that process for dramatically reducing the world's still very large stockpile of nuclear weapons. He co-chaired the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty as well. And I almost forgot, Gareth Evans was once a member of the Australian Parliament for 21 years, a cabinet minister for 13 years, including 8 years as foreign minister, when he was involved in such things as developing a peace plan for Cambodia and helping finalise the Chemical Weapons Convention. And on my far right, Joe Chandler, senior writer with The Age, the author of Feeling the Heat, her most recent book, Reporting Climate Science from the Front Line. Joe has a strong interest in reporting human rights and international development, climate change, Indigenous issues, social affairs, and her work has seen her undertake assignments across sub-Saharan Africa, Papua New Guinea, as well as rural and remote Australia, Antarctica and Afghanistan. She's won a lot of awards, including a Walkley commendation in the Quills Award, the Eureka Prize for Health and Medical Research, and the United Nations Australian Media Peace Awards. Please welcome our three panellists. Thank you. In the past year, we've seen a number of disasters locally and globally. Floods in Queensland and Victoria, floods in Pakistan, Brazil, the Philippines, an earthquake, a tsunami and a nuclear catastrophe in Japan, earthquakes in New Zealand, of course, and the slow motion emergency that we're seeing now, severe drought and food shortages across East Africa. Millions of people are affected by these disasters and they need help to meet their immediate needs and put their lives back together. And then of course there are an estimated 1.4 billion people who live in extreme and grinding poverty, never knowing where their next meal will come from. And this raises fundamental dilemmas, moral dilemmas for us as individuals, practical dilemmas for the art of government, and that's what we're going to discuss tonight. We may want to help others, we often do want to help others in pressing need, but how do we reconcile that with looking after our own interests and satisfying our own desires? On an individual and a national level, how far can and how far should we reach? Does distance make a difference? And does charity begin at home? Gareth Evans, does charity begin at home?
Well, charity might probably begin at home, but it sure as hell certainly should not end there. We can afford to be generous, and we should be generous. We can afford to be generous because the sums of money are manageable, even if, as the present government has committed us to, we increase our proportion of aid to 0.5% of gross national income, which means in dollar term from something like $4 billion a year now to $8 billion by 2015-2016. Even if we do that, we're still only talking about not much more than 1% of the national budget. A lot of people don't really appreciate that. If you do opinion polls and surveys like per capita a year ago, people always think that aid is costing something like 9 or 10% of the budget, but it doesn't. It's much less than that, and it's only, of course, about a seventh or an eighth of what we spend on defence. It's not only a matter of being able to afford it, it's something we just should do. Overwhelmingly, we should do it for moral reasons. Our common humanity demands that we recognise that others are of equal worth and dignity. And if we see suffering, we should do what we can within our capacity to alleviate that suffering. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that's always what aid is about. But there's another hard-headed national interest reason that I'd also like to mention right at the outset as to why we should be generous and not just think of aid beginning at home. And that's because any country's national interests, not least our own, really have to be seen as not just about the traditional duo of strategic and security interests on the one hand and economic trade interest on the other. We have an interest in being and being seen to be a good international citizen. And being generous in our aid budget is very much part of being just that. The returns that follow from being and being seen a good international citizen are not just the equivalent of Boy Scout good deed type returns, moral returns, feeling better returns. They're very specific returns. There's a reciprocal return. If you contribute generously to others, they'll be that much more willing to support you internationally when you're pursuing some particular specific national interest of your own. And there's also a reputational interest. We should never, ever underestimate or underappreciate the extent to which a country's general reputation for being concerned with purposes other than just ourselves can contribute to spin-off returns in all sorts of much more obviously hard-headed way in the rough and tumble of international discourse. We can spill that out a lot more, but they're the basic reasons why I would say, not just for good moral reasons, but for good national interest reasons, we should be generous.
Thank you, Gareth Evans. Sharon Bagwan-Rolls, what's your response to that question? Does charity begin at home?
Well, I think charity does begin at home, but in the context of the global village, our home is more than just our big backyard. I'm going to do a lot of my conversation from the women's movement perspective and in relation to gender equality. And the women's movement in Fiji and very much in the Pacific Island region came about as a result of the notion of charitable giving. My own mother had an opportunity to attend secondary school in the capital city of Fiji because someone invested in her. It was the church. And so that type of charitable giving has given rise to girls' education, girls' access to tertiary education. That continues today. And even in the context of the development aid agenda, we still need that kind of injection when it comes to livelihood programs, improved infrastructure. But I don't think we can just linger on the notion of charity as a gift, it must come with a sense of empowerment and gender justice, and empowerment for those at the community level who should be part of deciding where does that development assistance go, and even in the context of humanitarian assistance, that humanitarian assistance is not just in a one-size-fits-all package, but must be responsive to the needs of those who need it at the community level. Girls and boys have different needs, men and women have different needs, and I think quite often, when we think about charity, we think about these lovely little packages that are making their way there, but we're not really looking at the grassroots and the realities of what, why it's needed. But finally, I just want to add on a very personal note that when it comes to the issue of health, and in particular women's health, and in the last 9 months I've gone through a journey with breast cancer, that I can see that in one of the places or one of the needs in across the Pacific Island region where there is still a need to invest in is in health, and in women's health in particular, because women are the cornerstone of the homes, of the communities, and of our countries. And if we talk about women's political participation and parts of and being part of decision making, if a woman is not healthy, her family isn't, neither is her community or her country.
Thank you, Sharon. Judge Handler, Sharon has problematized the idea of charity a bit there. And when we talk about charity begins at home, in Australia, what that can mean in some people's eyes is we should be more worried about the floods in Queensland or issues within Australia than we should be about helping countries overseas. So there's a tension here, isn't there, in the idea of charity begins at home.
I guess so. It's going to be interesting, though, in the next coming decades, with the predictions that we've got about the impact of climate change on communities, regardless of whether you're sitting in a garden on the Papua New Guinea highlands or whether you're here with a bit of seaside waterfront in Elwood. There'll be a bit of an equaliser, I suspect, in some ways, but we will have the comfort of having a social support system and a network that looks after us in a way that those other communities just simply don't have. And I do get a sense sometimes in the kind of furor that sometimes follows, should we be giving our money to the Queensland victims of flood or to the ones in Pakistan, that a lot of people really don't have much sense of how little other support there is for people in an environment like Pakistan. And I was reflecting on this today, thinking about the bushfire scenario here, where hundreds of millions of dollars poured into support for people here, and nobody begrudges that. We all wanted to assist personally and as a state. So there was money made available for people to recover. I think every single person who was affected by that fire had access to a caseworker to help them manage, or was offered the access to a caseworker to help them manage their lives and rehabilitate themselves. They've got health support, they've got social security to tide them over. But if you look at the typical casualty of an extreme climate event, or even just changes in the way agriculture is working, sudden famine, sudden drought, sudden flood. If you are displaced from your village in the Papua New Guinea highlands and end up in the settlements of Port Moresby, and you're a child perhaps who's lost a parent to HIV, there's nothing to look after you and no one to look after you beyond whatever charities happen to find their way into the streets. So I think whilst we have plenty of generosity and spirit to go around, and I would hope that that can accommodate the people who are affected by catastrophic events in our own backyard as well as a little bit more distanced, there's not too much between us really. A little bit of water, as long as we're sharing the same atmosphere and the same oceans, we're going to be in the same stew eventually.
Well, Gareth Evans, it is often presented as a zero-sum game. You know, we either give to the Queensland floods or we give overseas aid. We either invest in Australian education or we invest in helping build schools in Indonesia. But it's not a zero-sum game, is it?
No, we're a rich enough country to be able to do both these things and do them generously, to do them well. It does, of course, involve trade-offs. It does involve prioritisation. We've got to make some hard decisions about how much we're prepared to pay in taxes as a community. We do have to make some decisions about what proportion of our national budget we're going to spend on defence hardware as distinct from this, and whether the proportions need to be as great as they are. And that's a much more compelling question, I guess, to ask a country like the United States, which spends extraordinarily large sums of money, as we know, on defence, more than the rest of the world put together, and comparatively very, very small sums on aid as a result. But the same logic does apply to us, and I think we should make those decisions which reflects the reality that we're not just doing it for the sake of those people on the ground. There's a very real national interest involved.
So let me put you on the spot. Should we be paying more tax and spending less on defence in Australia?
Well, I've never been a very populist politician for reasons that have very obviously left my career at a certain plateau and not gone a little bit high. And I mean, I've always been, I think, reasonably willing during the course of my political career to try and explain some of the hard decisions that we do have to make, to not pretend that the pie is full of sky and that we can all have absolutely everything. But in the context of aid, this is not really a very hard sell with the Australian community, particularly if you can get across the message that the proportion we are spending on aid of our national income and our national budget even is really quite small. Because people do think we're spending much, much more, just as they seem to think that there are many more refugees coming in or coming across the water in boats and so on than is the case. And once you can convey the story about the real numbers, the real relativities involved, I think it gets a little bit of an easier sell.
Sharon.
I was just going to say that back in 1995, 189 members of the United Nations, including Australia, including Fiji, went to the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women. And as part of the commitment to the gender equality architecture, to the women's human rights agenda, all those member states, but particularly those who were part of the ODA group of nations, made a commitment to advancing human rights, to advancing women's human rights and the gender equality architecture. And I think sometimes there's a real tussle at the national level where maybe the average citizen doesn't understand what the state has committed to, and so they don't know why you are following through. Whichever government is elected, you are accountable to these commitments, to human rights standards, to standards of women's human rights. And if I could just add, the floods in Fiji, in a small town, in part of our rural centre, when we hear about women who are having to climb up onto the roofs of their farm homes because they have nowhere else to go. Those are the realities that are happening, and it's not just one devastating flood and then nothing, but it's happening once, twice a year. So those are the realities of people who are very much not, as you said, Joe, part of any social welfare assistance, and they see their livelihoods destroyed completely. It takes 12 months for a banana plantation to revive. And if that's your only cash crop that goes to the market, what do you do for those 12 months?
I think we know a lot about that. Anyone who's tried to buy bananas in Australia recently.
We heard about that in Fiji. Yes, we were offering to sell some.
Fiji bananas aren't acceptable in Australia.
I know. Well, not much from Fiji is these days.
I thought it was interesting that Gareth a couple of times talked about, I guess, this the national interest and that and how that fits within the aid paradigm. And I mean, I guess the word charity, which is the one that we've constructed the discussion around today, is sort of carries this whole notion of kind of altruism and selflessness and goodness out of the goodness of our hearts. Whereas in fact what we're talking about, you know, my sneaking suspicion is that most people as individuals, when they tick the box to make a donation each month from their bank account, or when they find $5 on the dresser for that pest that's come to the door just as you're making dinner, I suspect that it's not always about purely motivated altruism. It might be about assuaging guilt. It might be about a sense of duty or fairness that's been drilled into you from your cultural or religious background. Or it might even be more cynically insurance that, you know, if we don't help these folk, they may well turn around one day and help themselves, and that might not be, you know, that might get ugly.
Oh, so they might come here on a boat.
They might. And I guess it's that sense, the policy that guides our giving as a nation, as taxpayers through aid and development, I mean, that explicitly enunciates that. You know, it discusses in the AusAid platform, I think, that, you know, we're there to AusAid directs its work to help develop countries reduce poverty, achieve sustainable development, but with the caveat in Australia's national interest. Yeah.
And that raises one of several critiques of aid, and let's talk a bit about those critiques. Gareth Evans, let's start with that one. You might call it boomerang aid. That is, a large amount of Australia's aid goes back to Australian contractors, is supplied by Australian companies. So that's one aspect of it. The other suspicion around aid is that Australia uses aid to advance political agendas like free trade rather than to address absolute poverty or women's rights or so on.
Yeah, I think all of us who've had anything to do with the aid policy over the years have been a bit anxious not to overdo the boomerang effect and to reduce the number of visible Australians hanging off the teat in that respect. Even though that's a crude way of saying it's in the national interest. I think there's some context in which that's completely unavoidable. I mean, if you are going to get into the governance support business, try and assist countries to professionalise their public services, their police and their judiciary and their armies and so on, necessarily you are going to have Australian, you know, people on the ground. But whether the suppliers of the particular foodstuffs or health commodities and so on should necessarily have to be Australian in order to justify the national interest box, I'm more sceptical about. I think we should be much more relaxed about that. But equally, when it comes to the other kind of returns, getting into the aid business for what can be argued to be at least a residual political return, maybe a vote for a Security Council seat in the present context, that might not be very far away from some people in government's motivation. But provided what you're doing is intrinsically worthwhile, intrinsically defensible, in aid terms, but if provided it is contributing to health or to education or to governance or humanitarian relief or environmental improvements or to infrastructure, rural development and things that are going to contribute to growth, provided it's got one or more of those particular spin-offs, the fact that it might also have an additional spin-off in improving your reputation, your standing, and the desire of that other country to do something reciprocally for you, we should be absolutely unashamed about that, absolutely unembarrassed about it, not be shifting our feet at all. Because after all, something like the Security Council seat will enable us, as a creative, enthusiastic, energetic, hopefully still middle power, to make a major contribution on a whole variety of global policy issues, which are beyond our reach when we're hanging around the backstage in these major international forums. So I think you can make a case for this in a quite clear-cut, unashamed kind of way. But it can't be just doing that and have a totally equivocal aid return to some hopelessly corrupt government where you're 90% sure the money's going to be diverted into some rich guy's pockets. I mean, just doing that to win a vote for something, Olympics or anything else, is not an attractive way to go, and I think we should be very condemnatory of that sort of approach.
Sharon, do you?
I think there definitely needs to be conditions of aid. One, obviously, in light of sort of corrupt practices, upholding human rights standards. I often get very concerned when gender equality and women's human rights become sort of like tick the box and yes, we've got some women in the program. So I think that must be sort of integrated and there needs to be better integration of these commitments I mentioned earlier. I think it's really important to look at the strengthening of civil society infrastructure as well, not coming in with sort of imposed values or ideas, but recognizing the local knowledge that exists on the ground. I mean, I'm happy to say recently, for example, we got our organization got a grant from AusAid to strengthen our community radio network. Now, that's something that recognizes what women are doing on the ground and the tool that it has as an opportunity to bring women's voices into a very difficult political space. But also at the same time, I think there's also that notion of ensuring that there's no sort of dual economy as we start to see. I mean, In the Solomon Islands, it's a really huge high cost of living for Solomon Island people, although people that are going in through the Ramsey project are living very expensive lifestyles. So,
and that can have a local inflationary effect.
Absolutely.
Because it's happened in East Timor, it happened in Cambodia, where you have a large influx of development workers, UN staff, peacekeepers who are being paid quite large salaries, very large salaries by local standards. And of course, they're spending pushes up the price of living.
Yes. So there must be a way to, I mean, it must be from the people. There needs to be more, as I said, the investment in the empowerment process so that people are able to decide and be part of a process. Otherwise, you're just creating a cycle of what's eventually going to be a conflict of some sort.
What about, Jo Chandler, an example of, you know, building a bridge? Let's assume it's a bridge that is a good bridge, well built and needed. An Australian engineer is paid a lot of money to work in the developing country to build the bridge. And a private Australian company, which was previously owned by James Packer's family, makes the profit from providing those engineering services. Does that matter when they're working alongside locally paid labourers on low wages and so on and so forth? I mean, does...
No, I think it matters profoundly. I was just, I've just been in PNG the last couple of weeks researching a whole range of stories which are coming. I'm assuring my editor they're on their way. But one of the things that we saw up in the Highlands, I was having a look at the impact of the LNG project, which is, you know, widely predicted to be a game changer for the PNG economy, ultimately perhaps doubling GDP. But right now, it's already causing profound change to the social norms within that community. And many of these changes, this modernity coming so rapidly, it's causing huge social breakdown, terrible violence towards women. But one of the things that occurred on the day we flew in was a couple of machete-wielding locals had taken a whack at a couple of Exxon staff working on the runway. Where the equipment for the LNG plant's supposed to be flown in the next couple of years. And this was really very much pretty uninhibited enunciation of how disenfranchised local people feel. Now, there's been huge efforts made by all the people involved to locate, identify the appropriate landowners, to provide appropriate compensation to them, to make promises about jobs for everything from, you know, local men being employed in the big machines to women being given some roles with catering, cleaning, all those sorts of things. But there's a breakdown there. There's an expectation and then there's the reality, and a lot of the people there figure all they're getting really is the dust that's coming off the convoys of trucks going down the road. The resentment at that is enormous.
There's a lot of different issues, Peter, though, which we've got to untangle here. Mm. One is the legitimacy of the infrastructure project itself, or the major commercial mine or whatever project. And that must be something that's not imposed on a country or a community. We've surely learnt that with the experience of the Bougainville copper mine, where I came into this debate God knows how many years ago, and many other instances since. We've got to be sensitive, and even if that prolongs the agony of the process of consultation and so on, that's absolutely part of the deal. Then there's the question about expatriate or Australian engineers and builders and so on doing it. Well, it's wholly, I think, a question of whether you've got the necessary capability available in country. If you do have it available in country, even if you're not getting as much of a spin-off back to the Australian national pocket as you would if you had Australian consultants and builders doing it, that's absolutely indefensible, I think, not to employ Indigenous capability, local capability in that circumstance, and similarly with the construction teams and all the rest of it. Australians versus other brands of expats, well, you can be forgiven, I suppose, for giving the nod, other things being equal, to your Australians in order to maximise the return and to, again, improve the saleability of the aid program to the Australian public, who's sceptical about things that don't have a national interest dimension to it. But if you carry that further than even a basic level of positive discrimination, I think you're diminishing the value of the aid pot that you've then got to go around, because you're obviously being inefficient and in the distribution of the aid in question. So by all means, have a national interest dimension, but for God's sake, be sensitive to the local dynamics and recognise these other constraints.
In the Pacific context, and I'm glad you talked about sometimes the fast tracking of consultation to do the business, because even in the whole Bougainville crisis, and as we do have in many of our Pacific communities, the negotiations with the traditional landowners, with the communities, it doesn't just happen with one business meeting. You need to be respectful of the process of that structure, and I found that too often things just happen so quickly. It's like, you know, the the convening of workshops. Let's have a workshop with 50 people. That's it. They've been consulted. Right, tick the box. Let's move on to something else. So how does this whole process fit into the realities of people's lives is it's what's really, really important. And I think needs to be the approach now, particularly if you inject peace as the cornerstone of development, of human security, in ensuring prevention of conflict.
Well, that raises a very relevant issue for you, Gareth Evans. I mean, is aid about peace and conflict, or preventing conflict and enhancing peace, or is it about poverty alleviation? I mean, what's the role of kind of peace and conflict in the aid program?
I think aid must always be primarily about poverty alleviation, poverty reduction, but one dimension of that is having decent systems of responsive governance in countries and avoiding the kind of conflict that can be total immiserizing to the community in question and cause even more distress and chaos and loss of life and property and opportunity than even... So it's absolutely legitimate objective to spend at least some of your aid dollar on doing things which are directly and plausibly directed to improving human security in that sense. It's been a long debate within the international aid community about this, and some aid purists, in a sense, have said, no, it's only aid must only be about very direct brands of poverty reduction, humanitarian relief, yes, health and education, yes, but it's really, really, really about poverty. Well, yes, it is, but you have to take a larger view, I think, about that. And that's now widely recognised and I think properly so, to the extent that some of the aid dollar in Australia and elsewhere is going to organisations like my International Crisis Group, which I ran in Brussels for 10 years, to the Global Centre on the Responsibility to Protect, another organisation advancing human security objectives in a mass atrocity crime context. I think all of these things are defensibly part of aid expenditure. They should not be a large proportion of the total, but they're an entirely defensible proportion of it.
And what about taking it a step further and using aid as a lever? So, for example, Sharon, in Fiji, you have a lack of democracy at the moment, a lack of elections. Should aid be being used by donors like Australia to try and lever the country back towards some kind of accountable democratic system?
I don't think anyone should do that. I think that needs to come from the people of Fiji ourselves, and that's part of the process that we've been, I mean, we're living through it for the last 5 years. We know we want to have elections, and it shouldn't be about somebody else coming and telling us we want elections. We know we need to have elections. We know we need to have a democratically elected government. But we also need to look at some of those root causes that have created that cycle of coups and political instability. And it goes back to your initial question about, is it about investing in poverty? I'd like to use the human security agenda as that checklist, because economic insecurity is very much linked to political insecurity, just as environmental insecurity is going to have some linkage with political security. So the more we start seeing that connection between human security, human rights, and human development, and for us, I mean, we know that a woman does not feel empowered, she does not feel like she can be part of a political process if she's hungry, if she's not well, if she's so busy trying to make sure that her children are fed that she's not feeding herself. So those are the linkages that we'd like to see made clearer as part of that political process.
I don't think we ought to be quite as purist as Sharon wants us to be about aid conditionality. Take, for example, the situation in Afghanistan at the moment. The international community has put in something like $60 billion into aid there, still only a tiny proportion of what's been spent militarily, but still a huge amount of money. And remarkably small proportion of that has got through to where it needed to get through to genuinely improve the quality of life of women, children, ordinary Afghanis, because of the squalor of the system of government and the individuals that are running large chunks of it. I think under those circumstances, to make further supply of large buckets of lolly totally dependent upon improvements in the quality of governance, the process of governance, the individuals who are in key government position is entirely defensible, because really it's one of the few levers you've got in some of these situations. And that's a way in which I think we need to look at the issue of aid conditionality as well. There are all sorts of villains out there perpetrating all sorts of human rights and other horrors for which the international community very often has very few sources of leverage at all. And we can get very purist sometimes, as we have tended to with Burma, Myanmar, and say no aid at all is going anywhere near that place. Another way of looking at a situation like that is to offer aid, but on the basis these guys, you know, get their act together and tend to behave in a slightly more civilized fashion. If it's a matter of withdrawing aid that's going into very visibly defensible community, humanitarian, health education purposes, and then you start talking about withdrawing that aid just in order to demonstrate conditionality, leverage to change behavior, that's a different issue, I think.
Where
you've got to be very, very careful that you're not, in the pursuit of some larger objective, actually doing real harm to people in that community. And before you go down that particular path, I really do think you've got to be very, very alert to what the people on the ground actually want you to do. Sometimes they'll want you to do that, as in the South African apartheid situation and so on, just anything at all which could possibly change the situation. But to exercise sort of judgments of that kind of conditionality can be a very tricky business, and you've got to be very sensitive about it.
Joe Chandler.
I guess standing back a little further from that, but just making the observation that when politics, security, strategic interests and aid all start getting close together, things can get very messy, and it can interfere with your effectiveness ultimately and the safety of the people that are delivering those things on the ground.
Well, this is a very live debate in Afghanistan, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
About the relationship between military forces and development workers.
And when I went to Afghanistan a couple of years ago to have a look specifically at, you know, not the fighting end, but at the development that we were supposed to be, or we were being told we were investing in the community around Tarin Kaut. And it was very interesting. One of the things we did was go to girls' schools that we'd built, and the teachers there, the women there, who are incredibly brave and really defended only by their burqas and anonymity on the street because they're under attack for teaching girls. You know, they're enormously supportive of the opportunity that was brought about by that. But I remember going from the school to the hospital and the women's wing, and having a look at these facilities that we'd constructed, and it all seemed a terribly good idea and a great facility. But I was in the truck on the way back in the Bushmaster going back, and then I thought, there was no one in that hospital. It was virtually empty. I reckon it's the only time I've ever visited a hospital in the developing world that didn't have streams of people waiting queued outside. Now, what was that about? Are they warned off? Are they not allowed to use it? Are they frightened? Was
it
just one day?
Is it too hard to get to?
Is it too hard to get to? I had a million questions, but by then it was too late to ask them of probably the only person who could have answered those questions for me. I could have asked, you know, the advisors and the soldiers around me, but I needed to ask the people in the hospital or the women, why is there no one here?
Again, this is a very tricky issue to manage in practice. There are some paradigmatic examples of particular aid organisations going out on their own into parts of the Badlands, including Afghanistan itself, developing a sufficiently confident mutual relationship with the local community to be able to do their projects without risk to themselves or anyone else in the community. And that's fabulous if you can do it that way. But in so many other parts of that country and others as well, you can only get people in to develop these projects in an environment where there's some sort of security being given to you by the military, by the security forces. And that does raise the very, very delicate question of the relationship between aid agencies and security forces, which the aid agencies hate to get into that sort of position of dependence. But if the alternative is to build hospitals which nobody is going to be able to use, or not to be able to do projects at all, then I think, again, it's just a matter of try to make the best judgment you can about the particular situation on the ground.
Well, also, surely, if an intervention in a country like Afghanistan is to be successful in the long term, it has to be accompanied by the building up of capacity, both in terms of physical infrastructure and, you know, governance and so on? I mean, there has to be an aid program that goes with a military intervention. There has to be nation building, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a given. I mean, just in terms of the raw supply of resources the country needs, because it's just incapable of generating them internally to do the things that need to be done. It's a precondition for being able to do anything that you do have governance, that you do have security. We know that. But once you do have that, then certainly the obligation extends to pour the money in. And that $60 billion that's been spent in Afghanistan is still actually about $30 to $40 billion less than that which has already been pledged to be spent over that particular period. So there's an awful lot of doublespeak goes on, an awful lot of double counting, an awful lot of bragging about people's commitments, which is not honoured. And I think the international community has to have a long, hard look at itself in the way that it often contributes to these very difficult situations.
I'm often concerned that aid comes about in relation to governance, you know, helping countries in transition back to democracy, only when there's sort of masses of bloodshed and that, you know, under sort of so-called peaceful situations, the international community really doesn't know how to behave. That's why I'm sort of concerned that there is so little investment in preventive action and waiting for the conflict to break out and, you know, let's get a few people, you know, killed and maimed, and then maybe we know what to do.
So it's a sort of ambulance approach,
yes.
You know, that you rush in when there's a crisis. And I guess, Jo Chandler, this raises a question about the role of the media in a developed country like Australia. You know, let's be honest, aid stories are not sexy. Editors aren't interested in them. They're worthy. They're seen as, you know, the kind of thing you do because you should, not because they're a good story, unless there's a crisis. And then, of course, it's the front page and you get what you might call, or what has been called by others, you know, the pornography of poverty, the starving child, etc. And that gets wallets opening, but it also presents a very narrow and simplistic picture of the overall issue.
And look, they can be a hard sell to an editor to say, you know, I want to go to Papua New Guinea to look at what I consider a catastrophe, the rise in maternal mortality, which has doubled in the last 10 years.
So you're not talking rascal gangs and tribal fighting?
No, not even that.
I mean, which is, you know, that's dramatic, that's a story.
But there's a universal story here, and I think even if the blokes don't connect, the women do. And, you know, in that moment, you know, I've had the privilege of watching women have their babies in Kinshasa and Afghanistan and Papua New Guinea, and I've delivered a couple up the road here in a nice swank little hospital. It's the same experience, you know, except some of them get better bed linen than the others and we get attended to. But the essence of that process is very connecting. And I think if you tell the story powerfully about this is any woman's story, and but for an accident of geography, it is our story, these are the most compelling stories and we connect with people. So I guess when I try and argue with my editors and persuade them to run these stories or to send me or other reporters off to cover them, it's about being a champion for the storytelling and the value of the stories, and not allowing things to be defined all the time by an emergency that affects Australians, for example, and about being a bit challenging ourselves about new ways to tell kind of tired stories. One of the excuses that are often given, you know, people are fed up with famine stories, flood stories, the whole fatigue.
Compassion fatigue.
I don't think that we are necessarily fatigued if we are presented with the information in new, vibrant, deep, connected ways. And the onus is on us to bring out the humanity of the stories and the closeness of our experience. And that these are big stories. And also, it's interesting, the responses that we get to some of these sort of slow-moving disasters when we run them are just overwhelming. There is enormous interest. And I think anybody, and there are probably a lot of people here that are studying international relations, any of the courses at universities that look at development policy, international relations, you know, there are people queued outside the door. There's massive interest in these topics. And I think sometimes editors, news editors, chiefs of staff, perhaps underestimate how much people want to hear these stories.
Joy, what would you be doing right now in the specific context of the famine in Somalia, which is as big and as ugly and as alarming a disaster story as has ever had to be told? And I mean, your paper is having a reasonable fist at it, but are we getting traction on this? I suspect not. What more could be done?
Well, this is one of the problems that we've got with the collapse of newspapers, and they, you know, historically they've had a big role in determining what news was on the agenda. But with the hemorrhaging of advertising out of the larger, you know, the papers like The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, the budget's not there to send people anymore. And so to have that consistency, I mean, if I had the influence and the budget, I'd probably try and have someone there telling an ongoing story. So it's not just that kind of pornography of the initial horror. You dig deeper and tell people more about the dynamics behind it. But these days you're actually left with quite a difficult choice. Often the only way to get access might be going in with an aid agency, for example, and forging a relationship and perhaps piggybacking on their logistics or even using some of their media budget to get your staff in there to tell those stories. And that then creates another dynamic where we no longer have a separation and we're not standing far enough back to be able to really tell the story in a completely honest way. And that presents a whole new paradigm of dangerous...
Because you can end up becoming a campaigner or
well,
seen as
yeah.
a campaigner.
Well, yeah. And there was a journalist called Linda Polman, a Dutch journalist, who wrote a terrific and one of the most horrifying and confronting books I've ever read about development policy. And there's, you know, there's loads of gospels of development these days of, you know, Easterly and Collier and Sachs all going at it about what works and what doesn't. But Linda Polman's sort of investigation after 20 years in Africa about the kind of unintended consequences that might come on the back of a humanitarian crisis and the capacity of media to, you know, to stand back and report honestly about those things has really been quite diminished, and it's worrying in itself. So, you know, I don't know, Nigeria, I wish Somalia, I wish we had, you know, I would like to think that we had a reporter there filing a deeper, different story every week.
Yeah, well, from past experience, you know, over many years, I mean, the stories that resonate are the individual stories,
yeah.
Unquestionably, rather than the groups, the big numbers, the stats, the underlying dynamics. Yeah, that's just analysis.
Well, Nicholas Kristof's
I was going to specifically mention Nick Kristof.
And the puppy of Darfur.
Because, I mean, he's just been unbelievable the way in this period from the New York Times who goes into these hell holes around the place and tells stories of individual women particularly, which have just really, really resonated and exploded into at least one segment of the community's consciousness, those that read the New York Times. But I think we should be doing much more of that, and maybe some of the aid budget. We talk about the aid budget, the aid effectiveness review talks about better communications and all the rest of it. Maybe better support for a harassed and strung out media to communicate the nature of the problems being addressed by Australia and other people's aid is one very useful way of spending a tiny part of that growing budget.
But for the journalists, the same conflict would potentially emerge as being seen to be on the AusAid payroll to some extent, or sponsored by AusAid or whatever. Well, it's a fraught area. Look, I wonder...
Most journalists in my experience, Peter, have never been over-concerned about that particular dilemma.
They should be.
Yeah.
We should be.
And in this
we
context, you can live with your conscience. Aren't you?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the ABC ran an appeal for East Africa recently. Mm. You know, ABC listeners donated very generously to that appeal. Mm. But it means that our focus was on that week and then it moves on. And there's also, I suppose, there are legitimate discussions to be had about whether it's the ABC's role to be appealing for funds. Anyway, we'll leave that one for this forum. I want to come to the audience in just a second, but just before I do, Sharon, how does this media debate look to you, looking at it as someone who works with the media from the sort of bottom up and from... a country that receives development assistance rather than one that gives it?
Well, this morning I learned that Beyoncé Knowles is pregnant and that Lady Gaga has an alter ego. And it made me think about, does anybody really know about the young Pacific Island woman at home who's grappling with her sexual reproductive health rights? And I thought, you know, that doesn't cut it, particularly in the mass media approach. I'm really talking about the commercial media. So we do have journalists like you, Joe, who want to follow through, who who see the need to tell that story and make sure it comes through. A colleague, Geraldine Coutts, doing the Pacific Beat, you know, she rings me, rings me up regularly to provide that space, which is more than the 60-second soundbite. But in the context of the research that's gone on globally through the Global Media Monitoring Project, unfortunately, in Pacific Oceania, in the last round of the research, which included Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, and Tonga, so very diverse media environments, women were still being represented as victims. So the stories about women are victims of domestic violence. Women are victims as a result of discrimination. The stories of women's empowerment and their innovations weren't coming through, and that's why we're using community media to tell those stories of the women who are making a difference in their communities, but remain very invisible in her own country, and therefore not able to break into that kind of political space. So, yeah.
Okay, we have a roving microphone. If you'd like to raise a question, there's one down the front right away here. I'll ask you to keep your questions, you know, concise and to the point so that we can get through as many as possible.
Of course, aid can divide into two areas generally. You've got the emergency aid, which you talked about initially, and secondly, the sustainable development. Can you comment on two things? One is we've thrown millions of dollars at our own Aboriginal people, and there's been a limited amount of success there. Why should we be more successful by throwing aid at other countries, Aboriginal people and others? And number two, can you also comment on the population influence, the size of families?
Okay, I'm glad I'm not the one answering the questions. Who wants to tackle that one first?
We'll talk about
the Indigenous question. I mean, the question is, we've thrown a lot of money at Indigenous issues in Australia with not enough success. How can we expect to achieve better internationally?
Well, of course, this is the nub of the criticism that is advanced by people like William Easterly, and say that the only thing that matters is economic growth, and the only way you're going to get economic growth is by recognising the reality of Indigenous dynamism and somehow finding a way of stimulating and encouraging that, because everything else is going to be squandered, everything else is going to end up in the pockets of the plutocrats or the warlords or the misgoverning classes around the place. Look, there's some truth in the fact that an awful lot of money has disappeared into those kinds of pockets. And I myself have mentioned the Afghan situation as a horribly depressing example of just that. But does anyone really think that the 200 million insecticide-treated bed nets that have now been distributed as a result of this massive focus on anti-malarial activity would have been remotely able to be produced or distributed without straightforward humanitarian and health-related aid coming from governments that are determined to do that? It's just an absolute necessity, I think, to recognise that however difficult it often may be to ensure that the dollars get through to where they're most needed and that you do get the bang for the buck, you've really got to, I think, at the end of the day, recognise that you can't do without that kind of aid. In the situation of humanitarian emergencies, in the situation of providing basic health and education in countries where they are just stuck in poverty traps of one kind or another. One thing that's emerged in the Africa debate is a contest between those who say, well, you know, Africa should have managed to develop its own growth path in the same way as that the Southeast and Northeast Asian countries have done without any particular dependence visibly on aid. But people like Jeffrey Sachs respond to that by saying, I think very credibly, geography has played a gigantic part here. The nature of the country, the absence of river systems and impenetrable terrain, the climate with all the implications of that for health and welfare, the isolation from world markets, the nature of the products that can be produced, are all fantastically important explanations for why things have dragged behind. I think all you can do is recognise that you've got to work like hell across the spectrum of these issues. You can't ignore the cries of people in distress in humanitarian situations. You can't ignore the cries of women and children and for education and for health of the most rudimentary and basic kind. We've got to try to provide it. But also, you've got to take a longer view as well and be prepared to take risks in infrastructure projects, and throwing money at governance, law and order systems and so on, even though the returns are often very, very difficult to calibrate, and the possibility for siphoning off is sometimes in those contexts even greater than elsewhere. But I think you've just got to do the lot. Get smarter about it, yes, get more and more responsive to Indigenous local dynamics and understand the situations you're going into rather than just careering around throwing money at things and wanting a national badge on projects. Coordinate with people that know what they're doing. Be less worried about the badge than the delivery. There's all those nostrums that are critical both for governments and for aid agencies. And if we did those things much better, I think that criticism of the kind that you mentioned would be much less powerful than it tends to be still at the moment.
Okay, I'm going to invite Sharon and Joe to respond to the second part of that question, which is about family size. The global population is going to hit 7 billion in October this year, 9.5 billion by 2050, possibly 10 billion by the end of the century. That poses huge challenges in terms of food supply, water supply, energy supply, so on and so forth. What is the relationship between development aid and population?
In the sense of controlling population numbers, I'd be really worried about that because I believe in a woman's right to choose, even though it might be in a very difficult situation. But we have found in the work that we're doing at home in some very poor rural communities that it's in that poverty that a woman isn't able to choose. She isn't able to access the kinds of reproductive health rights care that she needs. And so she's burdened by she becomes a baby-making machine because she doesn't have that kind of power. And it's so, that's what I was saying earlier, it's all inextricably linked. You can't just talk about economic security without the health security and the political security. So it is connected in that way. And I think in the poorest communities, you'll find that they are the ones with the high number of children, but there is a reason behind it. And so we must be looking at what are those root causes and where do those communities and those women and girls need the kind of support.
Jo Chandler?
Oh, just to back that up, I can't tell you how many discussions I've had with groups of women all over the world, often with, you know, a child draped off their back, one on their hip, one at their feet, and they want access to family planning, really basic family planning. And often either it's not accessible or they have to hide it from their men who don't approve of it. So if there can be more investment in the programs that can support them that's going to alleviate many, many problems because they'll be able to support their families.
And in terms of statistical data, there's a clear link, isn't there, between women's education, improved economic circumstances and falling birth rates?
Yeah, absolutely. Universal proposition.
Okay, we have more questions. So one over here, please. And with the hand up. Yep.
Hello, Jacqueline Pascal. First off, I agree entirely with child. If you teach a child to read, if you teach a girl to read, the woman she becomes can read a contraceptive packet. She can also read a notice regarding vaccinations. A boy, if he's taught to read, can read about rotational crops. And a whole community can begin to make informed decision along the democratic process. So it's very important. However, I do have a question to pose to the forum, and that is, do you feel that in tonight's forum, amongst the three of you, there is a hole? Because none of you are coalface, working at the coal front, aid workers in emergency response and in the current situations. Do you not think, or do you perhaps feel, that you're not entirely qualified to talk about international emergencies when none of you actually currently work or have recently worked in those? And is that a supposition on my part or is that fact?
That's perfectly true. I've never been out there hauling stuff around in communities. I've sure as hell been making all sorts of judgments about what ought to be done. I've been on the ground in many, many of those situations as an observer and encouraging analysts on the ground to tell us the story so that we could get it out to the policy-making community. I think we've all got our separate roles in this respect.
No, I absolutely agree with you, but I feel that perhaps the panel would be more enriched to be juxtaposed against the intellectual, the political and the media stance, as well as an aid worker who's currently...
Let me just say that we didn't organise the panel. We were invited to take part in it. So we'll feed that... Well, I think the organisers can see that criticism. But yeah, Sharon.
My work at home in Fiji is to assist in the coordination of rural women through the community media network. And one of the areas that we're starting to do a lot more advocacy around is gender and disaster risk management. From the as a result of working with women who, as I said earlier, have suffered through floods, cyclones, and hurricanes. So while I'm not one of those people that collect the humanitarian assistance, myself, my daughter here in the front row, we have visited and worked and documented women who have suffered through the floods. And part of my work is to be able to raise the reality of what women go through when they are living through these humanitarian disasters or these natural disasters and some man-made ones at the same time. So I come from a very practical background. I'm not a bureaucrat nor a politician. I am a feminist and I work in community media in Fiji. And that's the reality. Those are the realities I bring to this forum. So I hope that helps clarify that I certainly am not sitting here pontificating about some feminist theory, but it comes from the realities of women that we work with in Fiji, in Solomons, in Bougainville, as well as Tonga. And that's who I represent here on stage.
Okay, we had another question over here at the very front. The microphone's just coming to you.
There appears to be a massive imbalance between those, especially in Australia, who want to reduce tax than those who would take communal action and those who would denigrate aid rather than those who would try and promote it. And the question is, who are the groups who are actually lobbying and how do they lobby for increased aid? How effective are they and what can we do to actually try and get the aid up and get the balance, this imbalance between sort of the selfish and the communal in a better balance?
Well, the most effective lobbyists have been the aid agencies and organisations because there are in Australia a number of them, CARE and World Vision and Oxfam and so on, that have been right up there in terms of the international effectiveness and have a high level of credibility, both I think with the wider community and with government. And their lobbying efforts have really been pretty successful. I mean, we are now seeing an explosive increase in commitment to aid at a time of nonetheless acute budgetary stress. We're going up from 0.33, I think, to 0.35 just this current year. The target is to get all the way up to 0.5 of gross national income by 2015-16. That's way, way in excess of what we've ever managed to achieve nationally before. And when we've got there, we'll be in the top 10 aid donating countries in the world. And I think you can attribute an awful lot of that to, you know, particular individuals, not least Kevin Rudd himself, who's passionately committed to this and fought like hell in the way that a number of his more recent predecessors did not for that particular aid budget. And to be fair, there's a reasonable amount of bipartisan support for this, even with all the other sort of crude populism that's been going on in so many other contexts. There hasn't been so far much of this heard in the context of that aid commitment. I'm waiting for that to start turning up, and with Mr. Hockey saying he's got to cut $70 billion off the budget next time round, I have a horrible feeling that this is going to be one area where that axe is going to fall as the wet finger is waved in the air, and there's a perception that the community support is not all that hot for this. So I think it's an ongoing struggle to consolidate those gains that have been made, and very, very important that we get a wider toehold in the community on these issues and wider flow of messages going into government both sides about this than just relying on the specialist lobbyists who have been very good about this. But I mean, some of the papers have been very good. I mean, people like Joe and the writing over the years in creating an environment for this. And Australians are instinctively a bit more generous than we sometimes give ourselves credit for. I mean, both in the private amount of aid that's and money that's given in support for international as well as local charities is really pretty high by international standards.
It's about $800 million a year, as I understand. Let's do a quick, before I come to Joe and Sharon on this, let's do a quick exercise with the audience. Who here regularly donates to an international aid agency via perhaps their credit card, their bank account, monthly donations, and who in addition, maybe, or now you can put up your hands if you give when you get accosted on the street, or there's a particular, you know, campaign on, or someone knocks at your door. So now that possibly, I was going to say that in response to the question, how do we, how do we reach those people who think AIDS is a bad idea or are opposed to it or whatever? One of the ways might be forums like this, but I suspect then they're not here, which is part of the problem. Joe, and then Sharon.
Just addressing some of the things that you raised and a couple of things that Gareth said. I guess there's generally, you know, we have had a doubling in the last 5 years and a doubling in the next five that were anticipated. So clearly the lobbying, or there's a commitment there. A lot of that bipartisan support may be because there's, you know, there's something for everyone in development aid policy, whether you're a soft heart or a hard head. There's either markets to be won and conquered, or there's, you know, human suffering to alleviate. But either way, it's the same mechanism in theory that will get you there. It is interesting, though, that sort of CRUDA tabloid attack. It pops out up about once a year that you'll get the, you know, headline of AusAid fraud, you know, exposed. And it's quite interesting because they got whacked back when they had a crack at it a couple of months ago, because it was so easy to be able to say it's such a tiny amount that's involved overall. But there's a much bigger issue there, which is the whole big question of, is aid ever effective? And that could be a much bigger, much richer, much more divisive story, but there's no easy kind of way into it.
And there's no easy answers either.
No, and from Gareth earlier. You know, I think Stephen Howes from ANU, who was one of the participants in the aid review that we've just had, published a paper not long before the aid effectiveness review came out, where he said really to ask whether aid is ever effective is too hard. We can never really know. All we can do is address the question of how to make it more effective. So you know, I think it's interesting that media-wise, addressing that really big curly question hardly ever occurs, and yet we have little cracks and pot shots around the edges, and
clearly difficult to measure. I mean, you know that an insecticide impregnated mosquito net stops a mosquito, but you don't always know whether money invested in a good governance program results in a better government, or if the better government came about as a result of a whole lot of other factors. Mm. Sharon,
I think it's really about the process, and this forum itself, you know, the collaboration. IWDA with World Vision in bringing kind of issue into the public space is very important. It's also about the process of working with your counterparts in the country, and that kind of approach, I think, is also one way to help help people understand in why there is a need to invest in aid to give to support a country or a community in need. And rather than sort of bringing sort of a neo-colonialist approach to it, engaging with the communities, I mean, that's one of the benefits of partnerships, if you look at it in that way, you know, partnership for development rather than just, you know, here, have a basket of something and that's the aid. So I think it's about a process. And the more civil society collaboration can be encouraged to have that kind of discussion and engagement, I think you can see it probably a better approach to the whole development assistance process.
Okay, another question down the front here.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, we have had discussions about different players, the media, government, civil society and aid agencies, but not about ordinary individuals. And Gareth Evans, you mentioned that there are two things that you mentioned which were at odds with each other. On the one hand, a perception that the community isn't interested in giving, and then on the other hand, that Australians are actually quite naturally generous. And I've just watched my father do his tax, and he's reflecting, I think, a difficulty of connecting ordinary individuals with the giving process, which is that he gives to the people who knock at the door or in response to an advertisement or an article that he sees about a disaster. And so it seems that that element of the picture is not very joined up, of connecting ordinary individuals to the process.
I think people are generous when they believe that what they're giving is going to have an effect, and they understand the connections, the nature of the problem that the gift is supposed to address and the way in which it'll be done. If they don't understand, if it's just a broad general sort of abstraction, then it gets a bit tricky to get people's commitment. So always the task, I think, to get people more committed. is to, you know, be able to persuade them about the utility of what they're doing. And that's, you know, that's what the best of the Oxfams and so on, the World Visions, actually do, and do very well. But it's hard. Well, all I'm saying is there's an instinctive reservoir, I think, of natural generosity on the part of Australians, which we see surging just in unprecedented dimensions when, not just domestically, but internationally, when things happen, you know, like the tsunami in Aceh and elsewhere. It's not just a matter of being at home. When people can visualize, understand, empathize, relate to the suffering and the issues that are involved, they're very generous indeed. And it's entirely natural that they should be a bit more cautious, a bit more diffident when it's all just abstractions. The other message that I think it's very important to get across is the one that I began with right at the outset. People do need to realize that there's not as much of the total taxpayer pile of money going into aid as they tend to instinctively assume. If they think it's already, you know, $1 in every 10 that the government is spending on everything, well, you know, they'll naturally be a little bit circumspect about encouraging more. But when they realize it's only, you know, 1 cent, I mean, it's 1%, it's a different story altogether. And I think that's part of the messaging that we really have to focus more on, those of us who are passionate about doing more.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. We have one just there. And let me know if there's someone who I've missed, but, yep.
Who's asking a question?
Just over here, yep, thank you.
Hi, the topic tonight about whether charity should begin at home. I was thinking about the idea of home, and in a home you've got a very holistic approach to addressing people's needs. And I find that often, I don't know if it's just my perspective or something, but in an emergency situation, it's very hard to provide that holistic approach. And often external structures are imposed in a country and you can't provide ongoing support because there's not funds, or you can't provide a more holistic approach. And I was wondering how you members of the panel would address this idea of a holistic approach to development, and whether that's a practical idea or whether it's idealistic.
So it's a kind of philosophical question, I think, isn't it? About, on the one hand, seeing an immediate disaster and a need and, you know, putting your hand in your pocket, as opposed to a longer-term approach that is about, to use a badly overused term, capacity building, enabling people, you know, to a stable, ongoing, sustainable society.
I was thinking about the same sort of things. One of the last things I did before I came back from PNG was visit some communities down on the South Fly, which is basically about 15 minutes in a dinghy from the Australian territorial waters. And on one side of this invisible boundary there, out there in the water, you've got the health and welfare system that's number two in the world. And on the other side, you've got 137 and sinking like a stone, I think. So it's this kind of arbitrary border between people who can, you know, almost see each other at low tide, and the division between them, I guess, but the connections between them made me think a bit about, like you, reflecting, well, what is home? Is it defined by who are our neighbours, who are our clan, who do we identify with? I mean, I guess maybe I'm a bit idealistic like you. I like the notion of a ongoing, sustained, holistic approach to these things, because the Band-Aid emergency effort never really seems to, you know, it plays a really important role in a catastrophe. But for the kind of slow-burning, ongoing crises that are really part of the landscape now and inevitably going to be more so, I think there's an Oxfam prediction of, you know, 350 million people will be casualties of climate-related disasters alone within the next few years, a 50% increase on a few years ago. The emergency Band-Aid crisis caravan rolling in there all the time is never going to be enough. It's that holistic connectedness, I guess, that we need to foster, and this whole notion that we are you know, global citizens now through markets, through communication, through aspiration, and atmospherically.
Sharon.
I was just trying to think which story I should tell from which community, and I think I'll go back to, I don't know how many of you know Fiji, but if you fly into Fiji, you fly into Nandi, the international airport, and we work in that community with women who are community leaders and young women. And for many years, they were dealing with floods as a result of women living along the riverbed, and the flooding was affecting the women in the organized settlements, but also at the same time, the floods were being caused by development that was taking place, and the women were losing their food security. They weren't able to fish, collect crabs to be able to sell at the market. And they didn't have a space to speak in. As a result of our community radio engagement and documenting these women's stories, we were able to get them connected to a committee called the Nandi Basement Catchment Committee. As a result of that, the women were able to stop dredging in the river. And when I talked to them later, one of the women said, "I would never have been able to stand up in my village and challenge the Durranganikoro, the village headman, with my concern." And this has been a concern for her for, well, we met in 2005, and we were talking towards the end of last year. She said, but as a result of coming into our group, into our network, raising our issues, talking about it on the radio, and then being able to access some government officials, it's now been stopped. So I think the issue is, yes, you need to sometimes address the flooding, but you must also look at empowering those communities who experience the flooding in order to resolve that environmental security issue. So it's a bit of both.
I'm going to give the panel a chance to make some final comments and to, I suppose, tell the audience what they'd like to take away from tonight. But I also want to put it in this context. We still have, as I said at the outset, about 1.4 billion people in absolute poverty around the world, that is living on less than $1.25 a day. I think that's the World Bank figure. We are going to see a much larger population decades ahead. Everyone aspires to development, but clearly, I guess, we're not all going to be able to enjoy the levels of development that we currently enjoy here in Australia. So is the Charity Begin at Home message have another component, which is about a reflection on our own lifestyles as well and the choices we make here in a country like Australia? So I'll put that question and ask you to make some final comments. Joe Chandler?
I guess one of the tool of trade that I use, whether I walk into a hospital, into a school, into a village, into a marketplace, and you're walking in there as a journalist with your notepad and your tape recorder and maybe a photographer lurking at your shoulder, and you're saying to them, you know, "I'm a journalist, I'm from Australia." They might never have, unlikely to have heard of The Age, and tell them I'm interested in your story because I want to take it back home and explain the reality of life and the situation that you've got here. Tell me about the disease, the famine, the war, the issues that you face every day, the impact of the resources project, whatever it is. And these people are incredibly generous with their stories, and they haven't learnt to be cynical about journalists generally yet. I guess that's part something that will come with time and development. And so they'll pour out their hearts and they'll tell you their story, and you know, you listen carefully, sometimes a bit sceptically, because like anybody else in the world, they have their version of truth and the one that they will, you know, want to communicate. But often at the end of it, they'll say to me, you know, what will happen with this story, and what will it mean? Why do you want to collect it? And I tell them that that the people that read my newspaper pay taxes, they vote, they're shareholders in companies that either directly or indirectly perhaps have interests in their country. And I say, I don't know whether you telling me this story will ever make a difference to the circumstances you're in. I really, truly hope that it will. And I have over the years seen evidence of something coming back and a change occurring. But often it's this sort of, you know, this hope that they're willing to take the punt, if I'm willing to give it my best shot in communicating their story, that there are markets and maybe it's consumer choices, that if someone reads that story, they might decide to buy a particular product or not, or to invest in a particular company or not, or to move into ethical investments, or to go to a street march to object to something, or to vote for a party that's pledging more or less aid, or more accountability with the aid budget, or more direction into gender issues. So I do think there are powerful ways that we can influence policy as individuals.
And as much as we can often feel powerless, and when we look at some catastrophic event and the terrible things that it does to people's lives and their prospects, we are very powerful. And given the information, and given it in, you know, purely and honestly, hopefully we can all make a difference.
Gareth Evans.
Well, in answer to your original question, I think if you go to people in the developing world, you'll find that they're rather more interested in levelling up than they are in seeing us levelling down. And fair enough too. Fair enough too. Why shouldn't they have those sorts of aspirations for the kind of lifestyle for their kids and their kids' kids that we've got? And I think we should recognise that and do the best we possibly can to help them realise those aspirations. Obviously starting in the areas of the greatest deprivation, but recognising that we're all on this human lifeboat together. And I mean, that must be the beginning. I don't think it's the end of your approach to aid policy, but the beginning of it must be that empathy with our fellow human beings to recognise that they've got real wishes, real desires, not only for the most basic forms of human security, but for some of the higher aspirations as well, and do what we can as a rich nation to help them satisfy that. But my only other message, my takeaway, I guess, is again the one that I began with. I mean, politics, let's face it, everywhere in the world is a pretty cynical business. Government decision-making is sometimes moved by idealism, but rather more often by calculation as to what's going to play and what's not going to play. And the truth of the matter is that the best way always of harnessing commitment for intrinsically worthwhile, valuable causes is to find some hard-headed national interest clothes in which to dress up that particular support. As I said, you don't do it for hard-headed reasons alone and cynical and sceptical about the actual delivery. I mean, that's got to be justified on its own terms. But if you can articulate reasonable national interest justifications as additional reasons for putting a very significant proportion of our national income and national budget into aid, then you sure as hell should do so. And my view has always been that there are perfectly defensible and legitimate stories to tell about national interest in this respect. I've been in this business for quite some years now. I have no inhibition whatsoever of playing the game that way, because I believe it. I believe that Australia does get returns. I believe that we do get reputational returns and quite specific policy returns from doing the right thing. And if we can articulate it in that way, perhaps to some of the more sceptical segments of the Australian policy-making community and the wider Australian community, we're going to have that much better a chance of being able to satisfy some of those very human aspirations of our fellow citizens worldwide.
Sharon.
Obviously, the issues of women's human rights linked to gender equality are critical, but I just want to close by saying that next week, across the Tasman, Pacific leaders, including Australia, are gathering in Auckland, not for the start of the Rugby World Cup, but for the Pacific Forum Leaders Meeting. Australia, including New Zealand, and unfortunately Fiji remain suspended, but those Pacific leaders, including your own government, have made a commitment through the Pacific Plan to human security, to gender equality, to human rights, to conflict prevention. And if there's anything that you can do between now and next week, is to make sure that that message is amplified through the Pacific Leaders Declaration, through your country's leadership that attends there, to reaffirm those commitments. We're not asking for them to do anything new. I think it's just time to make good on the commitments, particularly for the empowerment of women and girls in your big backyard, which is the Pacific Island region.
Okay, this has been the 37th of these forums in the One Just World series, and One Just World does aim to get you talking and to get you thinking and to get you acting. And with that in mind, there are tables at the back in the foyer where you can find information about a variety of programs you can get involved in. So stop and have a chat before you head home. If you do have to rush off, you're also, I think, handed a piece of paper when you came in. There'll be some ideas on that as well. And the other bit of paper you were given was an evaluation form, which the One Just World team would like you to fill in if you have a moment to give your feedback on tonight's event and to suggest ways that they can do things better or other things they might want to do in the future. So hand that to a volunteer on the way out. There is a website. You can register to receive updates about when the video, for example, from this series goes on the website for One Just World. And, of course, these will be broadcast on the National Interest on ABC Radio National and on Big Ideas on ABC TV. On behalf of One Just World, thank you to our guests, Sharon Bagwan-Rolls, Gareth Evans, Joe Chandler, and thank you to you, our audience, for attending this evening. Thank you.